Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to the Prospect Podcast, where we speak to the brightest minds and talk about the ideas that matter in politics, arts and society. I'm Ellen Halliday, Deputy Editor at Prospect Magazine, and today I'm joined by Contributing Editor Tom Clark and former Number 10 Advisor, current House of Lords Labour peer Stuart Wood. Today we'll be discussing what the Labour Party could learn from progressive governments around the world. That's something that Tom investigated for the cover story of the current issue of Prospect. It's a piece called 12 Ideas for Keir Starmer, How Labour Could Win the Next Election. And in it, Tom argues that the Labour Party is short of a few good policy ideas, but could be inspired by some or all of the 12 tried and tested policies he's pulled out from countries including Finland, Germany and Colombia. We've invited Stuart along to take a look at Tom's suggestions and to evaluate whether they could work for today's Labour Party. Stuart was, of course, a special advisor to Gordon Brown in the Treasury from 2001 to 2007 and in Number 10 when he was Prime Minister. He was also later on head of communications for Ed Miliband's leadership bid, so we reckoned he would know a thing or two about the party and also how to run a campaign. Thanks very much for joining us, Tom and Stuart. Hello.
Pleasure. Hi there.
So first of all, Tom, before we get into the all-important ideas, arguably that's the really fun bit, I wanted to drill into why you felt it was important to set out these ideas at all. You are quite hopeful at the outset of the piece, saying that the tide of democratic politics worldwide is running in a progressive direction. Not everybody looking at the Tory leadership contest might agree with you. So why did you feel optimistic about the chance of seeing a progressive government in Number 10?
Well, I mean, I actually, to be fair and to be, you know, decently modest, I think it was yourself or Alan or someone else at Prospect who said, like, it all feels like doom and gloom here, but when you look around the world at the pattern of election results, it really doesn't look that way. It looks more like we're the kind of exception at the moment. And, you know, there's lots of Latin American countries like Chile and Colombia that look to be going to the left, as well as the more familiar, we know that America's kind of, you know, went left in its last electoral cycle, also Germany, and also all of the Scandinavian countries are now back with the centre-left. And it sort of feels like, you know, despite the doom and gloom in Britain, that Britain stands out as the exception. And yet it kind of feels like Keir Starmer is running a profoundly pessimistic operation. And this isn't a right-left point. Tony Blair came in as very clearly, from where I'm sat, looked like the most right-wing, openly kind of pro-market, kind of pro-consumerist Labour leader that Labour had ever had in the 1990s. And yet it was a kind of optimistic operation, not a defensive one. It was like, right, OK, we'll bag this from Thatcherism and then we'll move on in these ways. Whereas this feels a bit more like, ooh, the electorate likes some stuff, we don't really know what it means, so we're going to say, what's the new slogan? Security, prosperity, respect, and hope that gets us through until we have to write a manifesto. And so it feels very defensive, and it feels like quite a contrast with not only with Tony Blair, but also, say, with David Cameron, who was just grabbing around for anything that was out there before he came in. He was like, oh, the spirit level, this book about how equality is really important. We'll have a bit of that. People haven't thought about equality before, you know, as he comes in as a Conservative leader with a big agenda of cuts. But he wanted to kind of create a buzz, a sense that he was part of the change and grabbing at whatever was around. Whereas Keir Starmer, I think it's fair to say, would prefer to keep his head down. So that was the kind of spirit, really, of it. It's like, you know, there's optimistic mood music in the world, but there's very kind of downbeat mood music in Labour HQ, as heard from the outside anyway.
And Stuart, way back when, in about 2015, you wrote a piece for us here at Prospect called How Can Labour Be Socially Democratic Without the City? And in that piece, you wrote that progressive change must not simply be a matter of picking our favourite North European country and copying it wholesale. So what did you make of this exercise in light of, you know, that view that you put down on paper a few years ago for us?
I think the left is always condemned to be looking to Scandinavia in particular for inspiration. I think that's fine. I think what the point I was trying to make there was that it's easy to say, oh, I like this about Germany, we like this about Sweden. And the response is always, yes, but they're so different all the way down, those countries, that we can't just import their institutions wholesale. And that's true. And I think that's the point. But I think Tom's right. There is a sense that, you know, from Australia to Latin America to old chestnut countries like Spain and Germany, that the left is, if not thriving, at least it's squeaking back in and creating a bit of space to do things that are progressive. And I think the other thing that should give us encouragement is that the right has been forced to be incredibly de facto progressive with a heavy heart through gnashed teeth because of COVID, because of crisis, you know, cost of living, etc. Who'd have thought that Boris Johnson's would be the largest current spending government of the lot? You know, it's extraordinary outside of wartime. So actually all these things should give some encouragement. And I think, look, it's good to show that I think there is energy that comes from leadership in opposition that looks around the world, visits places, takes ideas back. I mean, you remember back in the day, even when I was a babe, relatively speaking, Brown and Blair in opposition doing what turns out to have been slightly unlicensed trips to the US to look at welfare to work experiments. The buzz around, you know, in the 90s about looking to Germany, other countries for different ways of organizing capitalism. Now, these things aren't the doorstep things. You're not going to go around knocking on doors and say, how about stakeholder capitalism? How about pre-distribution or whatever wonky Prospect article you might be your favourite. But what it does show is that you're in the ideas business, that you're planning for government, that you're looking for how the world's changed and what if different countries have tried, maybe sometimes failed to do. And that gives energy to a project, I think, which is really important as a part of the taste test of whether a party's ready for running power. I think Tom's broader point about Keir Starmer is a really important one, though. And I think the jury's out about the extraordinary risk aversion that Keir Starmer has as leader of the opposition, because it could be that he's right. It could be that actually, I mean, the analogy with Blair is sort of, I mean, which is often made by Keir and his people themselves, obviously, but what Blair didn't have was a change of leadership 2 years before an election. He had Major all the way through after he became leader. And actually, if Keir Starmer had produced a bunch of policies by now, just before a big change of leadership of the government, in the midst of huge economic uncertainty, I almost guarantee you a lot of them would have had to be ripped up again. So I'm not saying that's the reason he didn't do it. I think he didn't do it for another reason, which is that he wants to lead based on a character competition with the prime minister, whoever that may be. And I think he wants to wait to the last minute to drop policy. But it turns out that this risk aversion, this incredible tactical approach to being leader of the opposition, it might just be that it has advantages in the kind of last 2 years stretch of this parliament.
I think it might be right, actually, in terms of it will be enough to get you through if Liz Truss is as kind of shambolic as she looks like she might be, and you look like you're a steady hand at the tiller. You know, it might get you through. But what it won't do is it won't achieve any kind of enthusiasm whatsoever, particularly from young people, particularly from the large number of people who have fed up now because, you know, the country voted Brexit and it feels like the 48% didn't count for anything ever since, for groups like ethnic minorities who feel like they're written out of a lot of the mainstream scripts. Now, I mean, you know, compared with the 1990s, we are a much older country. Keir Starmer is a somewhat older leader than Tony Blair, but he is really like running as if, you know, he's taking charge of an old people's home almost in terms of those values of, like, you know, like I say, it's security, prosperity, respect, all with a kind of overarching bit of flag waving as well. So in terms of, you know, Tony Blair, like, you could see he was not running a left-wing economic policy, like I say, when it was the 1990s. But there was enough kind of novelty, enough freshness that meant that quite a lot of, you know, student people who were interested in the world changing in one way or another would go along with him. But I can't see youngsters doing that with Keir Starmer now, even though he might turn out, you know, better than we think in government. You know, he would say, I imagine that, like, that, you know, the party tried to get rid of Clem Attlee around the time of the 1945 election because he seemed like a dull figure as well. It's just that, like, every time there seems to be a choice to say something interesting or something boring, if you go for boring, people are going to feel quite bored by you by the time you get to the election.
I wonder whether we've actually got a different model of how to do opposition emerging here, which is, I mean, two things in particular. One is you try and get into power by saying as little as possible, because in an age of skepticism at politicians breaking promises and with such huge volatility, you know, politically and economically in the environment that he'll face if he becomes prime minister, you want to keep your powder dry in terms of not having promises you have to break. But I wonder, secondly, there's a different model of leadership of opposition in the sense that what I'm struck with as a slight outsider in the way that Keir's team run the show is they're essentially trying to run a kind of Cambridge Analytica opposition where their strategy is basically micro-targeting voters in different streets and different constituencies with different kinds of messages, rather than the big sweep of ideas and here's the 10-point plan for the country sort of way of doing things. I almost think they think that way of doing politics is a bit old-fashioned. And I wonder whether actually the success of the Brexit campaign has bled into the current leadership of the Labour Party thinking that that kind of micro-targeting of messaging is a much more effective way of getting just across the line than broad commitments that you will be held to and costed at and challenged on and all that kind of thing.
That's super interesting. I hadn't really thought of it in those terms. And I guess, so, I mean, if we come on to Tom's ideas, they are, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, but it feels like those are designed, they're exciting ideas. They're ones that could inspire people and kind of galvanise, you know, support. But they're not that micro-targeting. They are kind of these broader brush ideas. So Tom, before we kind of dig into a couple of them, could you very briefly summarize, you know, some, or if you can do it, you know, succinctly, kind of all of them, or the, you know, the most exciting ones of this list of 12 that you set out in your piece?
I better open it because it's a few weeks since I jotted this down, so I'll just remind myself what was what. But I mean, I did have in mind consciously as I was doing it, I mean, both, yeah, to find stuff that was in practice somewhere in the world or on the way to being in practice somewhere in the world. I mean, I also thought, you know, it is true, as the last election demonstrated, you know, absolutely, Labour does have to pull together a really tricky coalition of, you know, students and kind of disgruntled people who didn't go to university in the so-called Red Wall, and, you know, and they don't all want the same thing. And so, like, and as Stuart said, you know, the idea of keeping your head down might seem attractive because if the Tories are hated enough that people will vote Labour because they're not the Tories, that might work. But I was thinking, well, what happens if you try to approach the same puzzle but in a more positive way? So, for example, I looked at this pension idea in Denmark, which is essentially about saying people who've had hard lives working, like, long years in hard graft, you know, that they get their pension earlier. I also looked at something that's going on in Sweden about maybe bringing the trade unions into the discussion about immigration, where there's always fear that, you know, that native workers are being undercut. Well, okay, like, if the unions sound sensible on this, let's bring them into that discussion rather than keeping them separate. So both of those are, if you like, kind of Red Wall kind of policies. But then we've got other stuff on climate change, on decriminalising cannabis and so on, which would be aimed, you know, like some would call the campus left. And then we've got kind of some traditional social democratic stuff on social security and on infrastructure, which is the stuff that, you know, I think even now, although I'm not as sure as I was a year ago, even now Keir Starmer and probably most Labour people think is the kind of ground that can unite the Labour Party. So it's consciously a mix.
The idea wasn't that kind of all of these would work or even most of them, but rather this is like, you know, this is a selection, and would any of them take in the Labour Party or indeed in the country to kind of inspire people to vote for a progressive government? So Stuart, with your Labour advisor, government advisor hat on, you know, thinking in those terms, did any of these stand out to you as plausible, practical, you know, viable?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I'm not just saying this to be obsequious, but people should definitely read this article, because it'll make your ideas fizz around again, which I think on the left hasn't necessarily been the kind of world we've been in the last few years. So there's some really good stuff in here. I mean, a few things that are interesting about this. I was really struck by the Australian example Tom talked about getting a new independent head of the civil service in to have a sort of new broom approached to try and challenge some of the sleaze and the sloppiness and corruption of Australian. And I think one of the challenges Keir Starmer has is he's made such hay out of Partygate that the question is, what are you going to do when you come into power that'll show that you're not just going to be the next iteration of governments that everyone despises and doesn't trust? And I think something like I was thinking about a version of the Australian idea, something like an off-gov. You know, you have the same kind of regulator approach to central government that we have for the utilities. You could have an independent organization which actually scrutinizes and reports on the way that government works regularly, rather than just at the behest of the Prime Minister, as it seems to be at the moment. And I think that idea of giving institutional expression to something that politically has been really important to you in opposition is an important part of what it is to run up to an election. And the other thing that comes through a lot of these ideas, like the New Zealand unemployment insurance idea of a kind of top-up contributory element, is the way that I think the left gradually is moving much more. Some left parties have always been in this space, of course, but I think thinking about welfare and benefits and targeting income on those at risk is really difficult in a cash-strapped world, and it's really difficult when electorates don't think they've got enough money to pay the taxes to do it. More so maybe than 20 years ago, and certainly more than the Blair years had as a problem of their time. And I think one of the ways that the left copes with this is to turn unconditional into contributory benefits. I think that's an interesting idea. And I think, you know, contributory benefit systems where you pay an amount into almost like an insurance system for yourself, as well as a collective insurance system for the country, they tend to be much more politically robust when times get tough, because people see them as their benefits rather than just money going from me to other people who are feckless and don't work hard enough. And I think the idea of bringing that some of the spirit of that insurance principle into welfare is a really interesting. And then the third thing quickly is, I think one of the tricks of opposition is to inherit policy of your government, of the government that you're opposing, that you probably criticised, and actually keep it and give it a twist, which is what, of course, the Tories did with academies, for example, the specialist schools, academies in particular. And I think this levelling up has to be in that category for Keir Starmer. Levelling up has to be something that you inherit, but you can't just try and do the same thing. You can't use the Northern Powerhouse nomenclature and all that. And I think this infrastructure idea, I can't remember which country it was, Tom, where the infrastructure example you had.
That was just Joe Biden, US.
Oh, it was the US. It was a sort of, yeah. I mean, turning levelling up, not into a bit more cash for Burnley than Wigan and a little bit more cash for the Tees Valley than West Yorkshire, but actually making it about something branded, almost literally branded, you know, I think it could be an interesting Labour twist. And infrastructure seems to me, making it specifically about transport and infrastructure, something like that, I think, would be a way essentially of continuing the levelling up rhetoric and mission, but giving it a Labour stamp. So those are the ways in which some of these examples could be interesting. And while I've got the floor, one last thing. But the environment cases that Tom points out, the Norway electric cars, revving up electric cars revolution stuff, and fossil fuels being banned in Colombia. I think one of the things about that is, I think you have to find something that's big. You can't just have another £5 a week for insulation for your loft. I think if you want to do something on the green agenda, it has to be a big thing, a set piece, noteworthy thing, particularly as the Labour Party will be worried about people on its left flank and green flank not having any faith in Labour. So I think there has to be a signature high hitting policy which does the work for showing that you're serious about a project for 5 years for whoever's the climate change secretary.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to explain briefly, that Norway idea is basically that the Norwegian government cut in half tolls, charges, parking fees, that kind of thing for electric vehicles, with the idea that that would kind of push people into getting an electric vehicle and away from traditional combustion engine vehicles. So if there's, you know, something in these ideas that is potentially interesting for Labour, what about, I mean, are there some that you think Keir would never go near, Stuart?
Yes, I think the wealth tax idea, which I'm personally a fan of, but as Tom writes, you know, eloquently in the piece, you know, it's not the detail that's important, it's the principle. Because I used to work in the Treasury, right, for Gordon Brown for 6 years, which is a very fiscally conservative kind of place, as we're discovering at the moment. The Treasury thinks it's insane that we don't tax assets which basically, like housing, which generate huge, huge advantage for people. There's almost no tax on it at all. We've got a very imperfect tax at the moment through council tax and sales and stamp duty. But so there are assets that people in Britain have which generate huge income and therefore generate inequality. They're not taxed. And that's not about punishment. That's just about efficiency. So it seems to me that there is a serious case for a wealth tax, and I don't think Keir Starmer's Labour Party will touch it with a barge pole, because they think that it will be totemic of going back to a bad old Labour Party that is unelectable. I actually think the country's moved on that, but I don't think that Keir and the team, yet at least, think that they can be the people who make the running on the argument. So some of those larger tax things, I suspect, will not be anywhere near the top of Labour's manifesto.
Tom, this list was kind of aspirational in the sense that, again, you were picking out things that you thought were exciting and interesting. But what did you think was most realistic out of this list for the Labour Party today?
Well, I think there's absolutely no reason they couldn't do the pension one, which is essentially if you're someone who didn't go to university and started work or childcare, it should be said, earlier, and then you're credited, you get your pension earlier. Whereas at the moment, you know, if you're a guy who's worked hard in a factory and ended up with a bad back, but it's not quite bad enough to get you over the kind of like savagely kind of mean disability assessment, then you're on job seeker allowance, which has like awfully kind of stringent conditions right up till age 66 or 67, I think now. So like, you know, that would work, and I think that would signal a different fairness without costing much. I mean, on the picking up a few of Stuart's points there, which are excellent. I mean, on the wealth tax, I think, like, when I'm in my more optimistic mood about Keir, I think this is the only thing. I mean, obviously they're cautious. Everything about them is cautious, and like I said, they're going for old people who, by and large, own houses, which is where most wealth is locked up. So all of that points to caution. But if you see any of the front bench, including Rachel Reeves, Shadow Chancellor, and Keir Starmer, when they're asked, well, you know, you're not going to put up this national insurance, what are you going to do instead? They do always say, we need to make sure that, like, you know, money from property incomes and dividends and things is taxed fairly, rather than everything just going on wages. And I think particularly after this Conservative leadership election, whoever wins, and like probably Liz Truss will win and will cut taxes very deeply indeed, Labour was always going to get in needing some revenue raises in its bad back pocket. It seems to have set itself against any kind of general tax rises, which means it's kind of out of options. So I think, although I completely agree with Stuart, they won't want to get into taxing wealth, they're going to have to find a way to do it. Now, it might not be called a wealth tax, it probably wouldn't be, but it might be continuing to dramatically clamp down on big pensions, which, like, the Tories like have already started to do, and it's the way the tide's going. Or it could be a bit of capital gains tax on your first home if it's like worth over £1 million or something like that. There's different ways you could do it, but I really think that the public finances are in such dire straits and about to get worse that they're going to have to come up with something. And so anything they haven't ruled out might be ruled in by force of circumstance. So I'm a bit livelier on that one. The Australian one is really interesting because Anthony Albanese, if I'm pronouncing the new PM's name right there, has essentially run a Keir Starmer campaign. I think it called it a small target campaign or something, which is basically kind of keep your head down, say that the states will do most things, the Australian states, and and don't promise much, but make a big thing of this public probity. So that is very much like Starmer, and it won. It won pretty well in the end. So, but the crucial thing there is obviously finding a way, because, you know, Starmer does play with a straight bat and Boris Johnson was a, you know, terrible chancellor and all the rest of it and threatened the constitution. And so, like, it's just a way to make that graphic and make that live on after Boris Johnson has gone. And because, like, you know, putting the ministerial code on a statutory basis or whatever is really, really not going to be a doorstep thing, but saying, you know what, we've got David Attenborough or whoever to be in charge of this now just might work. So I think that's a really realistic one for them to look at. I mean, I'm going to just try and tie together a couple of things Stuart said there at the end about really about symbolism, both of the kind of principle, which would go with Keir's buzzword of respect and security, is this idea of solidarity or something in for something out. And also trying to make what Boris Johnson has called levelling up, but we'll find another name later about infrastructure. It's all about kind of finding something graphic that you can use to so that you can explain it. And I remember before the 2016 presidential election, which I certainly didn't call the right result on, but I do remember, like, people knew in Britain, this is, you know, people knew what that Trump had some policy. He had a wall and he had various big things he was going to do, whereas Hillary Clinton was talking about changing some tax credits for childcare and whatever, and it kind of, unless you're a policy person, you switch off. And so whether it's a new face on public probity or it's like you pay in this insurance stamp and then you know that you're not on a, standing on a trapdoor to poverty if there's a downturn, you've got 6 months to get yourself a better job or whatever, or like we're going to have a national recovery fund kind of infrastructure moment. And if you think of the great politicians of the past, like Franklin Roosevelt, who was a sort of centrist, certainly when he started out, like what they were brilliant at was finding these symbolic ways of painting in primary colours the changes that they wanted to make. And like the things that people remembered may or may or not have been the biggest changes they were making, but creating a new national park, the Tennessee Valley Authority, contributory social security, so no damn politician can unpick it in future because it's yours as of right. A real understanding for that kind of thing, which I think New Labour never really had. And it did a lot of good in a lot of areas, but it never made things that lodged in the imagination, with the exception of things like gay marriage that are a long way from, civil partnerships, a long way from kind of, you know, if it's reforms to tax credits or whatever, they can and were reinvented continuously before people, the public, had understood what they were about. So, yeah, I think symbolism is what we're needing. And in a way, this is the list of 12 symbols as much as 12 policy ideas in the way that Stuart or me would have thought of them when we were working in Whitehall.
Do you agree, Stuart, with that, you know, importance of a symbolic policy in kind of opposition to that very specific micro policy approach you were talking about at the beginning? And if you were advising the Labour leadership today, which one of these do you think would have that, you know, that symbolic clout that could really kind of cut through?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first part of your question, I do agree with Tom. I think it's really important. And I mean, it's a very wonky phrase, but something like a contribution revolution for the way that we do our welfare state would be an interesting way. You have to think of a way of branding it, which could imply a whole revolution, but a revolution in something that's traditionally been Labour's baby, but in a direction which is going to change the ethos of it. I think that would be an interesting counterintuitive, which some of these policies like the unemployment insurance idea from New Zealand would feed into. I think that would be interesting. How would I advise the Labour Party now? I mean, well, they could say, well, you work for Gordon Brown and Ed Miliband, they both lost, and so, well, thanks very much, but we don't want your advice, which would be a fair enough response. But I think that actually Keir Starmer's about to find he's got a very different kind of electoral conundrum than he had it back in June. Because I fear, from a Labour point of view, that what the Tories are brilliant at doing is moving on to a new Prime Minister and persuading the country that actually you've got a new government in town. It's like a fresh start. Boris did it brilliantly. I suspect Liz Truss, who is likely but not certain to win it as we speak, Liz Truss will probably not have much trouble in doing something similar. I think what's fascinating about the Tory party is that they're kind of, they're missing out the entire 10 years of debate about moving away from Thatcherism in this leadership debate. They've just gone straight back to two variants of Thatcherism, or trying to be the most credibly Thatcherite person is the way to winning the hearts of the Tory base. And I think that if Liz Truss wins, as Tom said, I think she'll bring in tax cuts quickly. I think they'll be quite big tax cuts. I think she'll probably bring in spending cuts as well and create a fight about that, particularly on public service, public sector costs. And I think that dares Labour Party to escape the challenge of being the high tax party at the next election, which is not really a problem that Keir has had up to now, day to day, I don't think. Secondly, I don't think Keir can play the it's my character versus the PM's character in quite the same way. And if Labour spends the next 2 years trying to say, oh, Liz Truss is just the same as Boris Johnson, I think the country will look at that and go, no, she's not. No, she's not. Okay, she was there and she has other issues as from character point of view, but it's not Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson's such a one-off. I don't think so. I think actually Keir's going to have to take policy more seriously as a defining and but he's going to have to do it within the straitjacket of the Tories having cut taxes and daring Labour to raise them again. And that, I think, is that's the real conundrum he's going to have to wrestle with. And so a couple of these issues, I do think the idea of an Ofgov, some sort of office of government, it's not going to change the world. But I think it does show that, you know, he means business about government being a different proposition. So that might be a kind of shop window change institution that will change things sort of offer. Mm-hmm. Along with something about changing the way that the welfare system works, maybe.
Yeah. So just as we, just before we wrap up, a final word to both of you on sort of your closing thoughts of, you know, your closing thoughts of how Labour should play it in the next couple of years until there is indeed, again, a general election. Do you think that the party is in a strong position, will be able to put itself in a strong position to counter the Sunak or the Truss government, the Sunak or the Truss agenda? What's your sort of closing thoughts on that?
I mean, I really do. I mean, everything is set for this to be a test of the old theory that, you know, oppositions don't win elections, governments lose them. It is a fourth term government because we had a couple of elections kind of a bit quicker than we ordinarily would have done. So I kind of think that we've lost track of that. But the public knows that it's been a Conservative government for a long time. Boris, I think, got a bit of license, as Stuart said, you know, brilliantly reinvented himself and the party. It's all a fresh start. But when we get one of these Margaret Thatcher clones kind of coming in and sort of like just saying, oh, it's all about cuts. And you know, the ideas they're kicking around are basically tax cuts. Let's, like today there's a story about Liz Truss maybe cutting public sector pay in poorer areas of the country. There's stuff about grammar schools. Like obviously they can and probably will kind of pivot a little bit after they've got this leadership election out of the way. But really it's like, okay, you've had whatever it will be, 12, 13 years of the Conservatives, 15 maybe by the time of the election. Do you want more? And I think that will, it's possible that will win, particularly because, you know, it's going to be so shambolic. It's not conserving anything. Liz Truss again today talking about the best thing to do with Nicola Sturgeon is to ignore her. Well, that's not going to work for holding the union together. So, I mean, if you're a sort of small C Conservative person who might be a right-wing Labour voter or might be a Liberal Democrat or whatever, or might have even been a left-wing Conservative, you kind of want a bit of steadiness and a bit of change at this point. And that might, you know, that might be enough. It doesn't mean that Keir Starmer's not going to win. But what I would say is that if you want to get in, what I'd be saying to him is, like, if you're going to get in, you want to have some enthusiasm, some sense that, like, bright, young, interesting people want to become Labour politicians so that you can renew a little bit in government, have some junior ministers who you can promote up the ranks, and make sure that you don't end up losing a few of those seats that have done quite well for Labour in 2017 in university towns and odd places like Canterbury. Because, you know, if Labour starts losing too many votes to the Lib Dems and Greens, you'll lose some of that. And then you get in with a tiny kind of majority and you don't really know what you're about and you can't either rule by diktat or kind of direction because you haven't said what you're about. And so it's possible to see Keir Starmer squeaking through, but it all being very disappointing, particularly with the public finance situation and collapsing and the Conservatives then getting in.
Stuart, did you want to give us a
yeah
final comment?
Well, just very quick just very quickly, I mean, Tom's completely right about the reason to create energy and excitement is because you need ideas on day one. It's you can't just go, what civil service, what have you got in the drawer? You've got to have energy. You get the first 100 days an opportunity, but they're also crucial to sort of produce policies that maybe you haven't talked about, but you want to do secretly, that you've secretly prepared that you want to do on day one, day two, like Gordon Brown and the Treasury back in 97 with Bank of England and New Deal, all that sort of stuff. So there's that. But also, you've got to give a sense that you're popular, that you've got a following, that there are people out there making the case for you, which aren't just stooges that you put up in front of a camera. You know, the sense that there are people out there who want to touch the hem of your garment is a really important part of being an opposition leader. And Wilson in 63, before the 64 election, he did a series of speeches around the country where he asked himself a question. It's always good because you know the answer if you ask yourself the question about what Britain would look like in 10 years. And this is his way of showing that he was his finger on the pulse of modernization. He was forward looking, future looking. He then published a small Penguin book with all these different chapters about, you know, what will the industry of the future look like, or what's happening to families. And talking about and going around listening to people talking about the kind of way in which you want the world to change and Britain to change is a good way of showing energy, but also a way of showing that you're listening and that you're calling for people to come and give you ideas. I think all of that is really important part of the preliminary of before you get to a manifesto stage. People always say, oh, he hasn't got enough policy, Keir Starmer, and where's the vision? But showing that you're asking the right questions is actually a preliminary to both of those things about the kind of country you want to build, you know. And I think that a bit more of that would be good, rather than just here's my 10-point plan for housing in urban areas. You know, go a bit to the how do we want Britain to change, and talking maybe in slightly more risky but open terms about those things. That's what I'd like to see at this stage.
We should just say, sorry, Alan, just before closing, there are some policies, which I deliberately didn't get into in this article, but, you know, there are some interesting policies on, say, employment rights, about, you know, a right to demand rather than request flexible timing, and some protections about people who've got very insecure contracts. But it's sort of left to Angela Rayner to talk about those things. And also, they've not been through the kind of spin machine in the way you'd want. So you boil it down and sort of say, you know, a life-ready job or something. I mean, that's terrible, but do you know what I mean? Like things that say, here is something that sounds technical, but actually is going to change the way that you live. It's left as, here's something about TUPE protection rights on blah, blah, blah. And no one knows what you're talking about. And one thing I really don't think I was exaggerating about is not many people could name a single Labour policy, apart from those of us whose job it is to kind of keep an eye on it. And so they've got a few of these things. And so, for God's sake, like, start talking about those, start the leader himself talking about them rather than leaving it to other people, because then you're not really taking any risk at all. The Tories are still going to have fun with that policy ideas and claim it's a tax on jobs or whatever they do, if it's Angela Rayner who's saying it, as Keir Starmer saying it. But there's no upside if no one knows you're doing it.
Well, there's certainly lots of food for thought for the entire Labour Party in your piece, Tom. If anybody's listening and fancies having a read of it themselves, then they can check out the latest issue of the magazine that's on sale now, or head to the Prospect website. Even they could subscribe if they want to at subscription.prospectmagazine.co.uk. Thanks so much, Stuart and Tom, for giving us your time today to talk through these ideas. Do also check out the Prospect Lives podcast, which is 7 stories, 7 voices on modern Britain, by searching for Prospect Lives wherever you get your podcasts. That's all from us for today. Listen out for the next episode of the Prospect podcast next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.